Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson, reporting. A delicate ceasefire in Syria is holding for a second day, in spite of repeated claims of breaches from both sides. Russia blames Turkey for 9 violations, while Syrian state media claims terrorist group fired mortars near the Turkish border into the coastal Latakia province. And a senior Saudi Arabian official in turn alleged Syrian and Russian forces committed ceasefire violations in Syria. Stefan de Mistura is the UN Special Envoy for Syria.
No doubt there will be no shortage of attempts to undermine this process. We are ready for it. We should not be impressed. We should not be overly concerned. We should address it and realize that this is part of any ceasefire and certainly of a cessation of hostilities.
The UN-brokered ceasefire was also negotiated by the U.S. and Russia and does not apply to terror groups, the Islamic State, nor the Al-Qaeda-linked al-Nusra Front. Cameroon's military has freed several hundred hostages and killed about 100 Boko Haram militants in a joint operation with Nigerian troops. This comes as the U.S. envoys confer with Nigerian military officials about possible deployment of U.S. military advisors to the region. Nigeria has struggled for nearly 7 years to stop hundreds of deadly raids and suicide bombings by Boko Haram Islamists. Baghdad was on high alert earlier today after ISIS extremists launched a surprise attack on Abu Ghraib, just west of the Iraqi capital. Suicide bombers and gunmen riding pickup trucks stormed the city in one of the boldest attacks by the Islamic State in months. Increased numbers of Iraqi forces were quickly deployed to the international zone, which is home to many embassies and international staff. This is VOA News. Reformists appear to be making big gains as Iraq continues to count votes today from its parliamentary election. Final results in most races are expected tomorrow. But Iran's official media is quoting President Hassan Rouhani, saying the election has given his government more credibility and clout. The race for the U.S. presidency passed a critical milestone last night, with Democrats in South Carolina going to the polls, choosing who they want to nominate for president. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports.
It was an exuberant Hillary Clinton who addressed supporters in South Carolina after a sweeping victory over rival Bernie Sanders. Though voter turnout in South Carolina was light overall, exit polls showed 60% of the Democrats who did vote were black, and they overwhelmingly backed Clinton. That advantage could also pay off in upcoming Super Tuesday primaries in Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, and Virginia, all of which have large black populations. Speaking to supporters in Minnesota, rival Bernie Sanders vowed to fight on in the Super Tuesday contests when 11 states hold Democratic primaries or caucuses. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Finance officials of the world's 20 biggest economies meeting in Shanghai this weekend promised to use all policy tools available to promote global growth and avoid competitive devaluations of their currencies in order to boost their exports. At the end of the two-day conference, finance ministers and heads of central banks in the G20 issued a statement acknowledging vulnerabilities have risen in the global economy. A financial crisis in Moldova, one of the poorest countries in Europe, is boosting pro-Russia parties and threatening the country's stability. VOA's Daniel Scharf, who spoke with the prime minister, reports interests are slowing progress and exploiting geopolitics, much like what happened in neighboring Ukraine.
Protesters in front of Moldova's government building collect signatures calling for snap elections, direct election of the president, and stripping lawmakers of immunity. They say the government is corrupt and controlled by influential oligarchs, a charge the prime minister denies in an exclusive interview with VOA.
We have sound minds. We wouldn't take on this responsibility if someone from the shadows would be controlling and capturing the state.
But he admits they need to take action to regain public trust. Moldova was plunged into crisis after $1 billion disappeared from banks. Western backers have frozen financial support until target reforms are met. Protest camps established last September raised comparisons with Ukraine's uprising, though all sides are so far showing restraint. Daniel Scherf, Chisinau, Moldova.
A police officer in the eastern U.S. state of Virginia was shot and killed Saturday afternoon during her first full day in uniform. Officer Ashley Gwinden and two other police officers with the Prince William County were responding to a domestic disturbance call. She died at the hospital. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
I think generally everybody agrees the elections were a success. Everybody seems to be headed to the courts in case they are not happy with the outcome.
The Electoral Commission of Uganda maintains the just-ended presidential and parliamentary polls were credible.
We urge the international community to support the people of Burundi in their efforts to find lasting peace and development for the country.
The African Union says it will deploy human rights observers and military monitors to Burundi.
We want IGAD to remain seized to the implementation of the peace agreement. The Prime Minister of Ethiopia is the chair of the IGAD. They are the mediation.
And South Sudan's rebel leader Riek Machar meets with Ethiopia's Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn about the implementation of the peace agreement. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Officials of the Electoral Commission of Uganda say they are prepared to meet the legal challenges opposition presidential and parliamentary candidates plan to launch this week following the outcome of the February 18 general election. Uganda's electoral law says challenges can be filed up to 10 days after results are announced. Opposition parties have disputed the results of the poll after signaling they will be going to court, saying voter irregularities led to incumbent President Yoweri Museveni's victory. Jotam Taremwa, spokesman for the Electoral Commission, told me the elections were credible.
No, I think generally everybody agrees the elections were a success. Everybody seems to be headed to the courts in case they are not happy with the outcome. But as a commission, we will continue to interact with our stakeholders to get an assessment of how we conducted our elections with a view of working out another strategic plan for the next 5 years as well as the roadmap. So for us, it is work in progress.
Well, you've had two prominent opposition leaders who have said they are going to court, or more than two who are saying they go to court. They have until Tuesday legally challenged the outcome of the presidential election. How ready is the Electoral Commission to meet them in court?
I think we did a wonderful job as a commission. We don't know why they are not agreeing to the results, but, well, they can petition courts. And we are ready to meet them in court.
Several international and local poll observers disagree with the Electoral Commission's stance that the elections were free and fair, particularly when they said there were some intimidation and harassment here and there of opposition forces or supporters. What do you say to their assessment of the general conduct of the election?
I think some of those international observers didn't have a good time to do some bit of research, to conduct interviews with key stakeholders. They came in towards the end of the process, and some of them really were not well versed with the political dynamics. But Ugandans are very happy with the conduct of elections. The international observers, I think, needed some more time. They came and they passed a judgment, some of them, not all, a judgment that we really fell short of the correct reading of the political processes in Uganda and the conduct of the prayers. And we are not really bothered. We are not bothered.
The European Union came out saying that it is incumbent on the Electoral Commission to publish immediately all the results from all the polling stations around the country. Will the Electoral Commission consider that?
Peter, as we speak now, you can get on your computer or laptop and open our Electoral Commission website, and you will access all the results from each of the 28,010 polling stations. They are there. They are accessible. And we have also given them soft copies of the results. So we have already done what they are asking.
What is the Electoral Commission's message to the people of Uganda, particularly those who felt they were cheated?
Well, I think to the people of Uganda, they are already going about their business. Maybe to the politicians of Uganda who participated in elections. Our advice to them is that they indeed should follow the legal established means to address grievances, and they should let the people of Uganda work. They need to live. They need to feed themselves. So we shouldn't unfairly keep the people of Uganda in elections, even when there are no elections, and elections were concluded. No. So, but we encourage them to petition courts and address their concerns there.
What is the security situation in the country? Do you think it's particularly protected enough to ensure that the rest of the elections that the Electoral Commission will be organizing will not be interrupted?
Ugandans are very calm. The situation is very calm. Ugandans are very happy. They have started happening. They are going about their business normally. And actually, if you come to Uganda now, you may not know that there are more elections.
Jotam Taramwa is the spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Uganda. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, Uganda's main opposition leaders have yet to concede the results of the recent elections. Reporter Douglas Mpuga reached the director of the Opposition Democratic Alliance, or TDA, a loose coalition of the main opposition parties, pressure groups, and civil society organizations. Bishop David Zach Niringi. Douglas asked the director what he thought should be the way forward.
It is very clear for me that this country, its future, is not going to be determined by neither the ballot nor the bullet. We have tried bullets. It's completely failed. We've not made progress as a country. We've tried several times the ballot. President Museveni himself and his team went to the bush because of a rigged election. Sadly, 30 years later, we are back to the same place. A massively rigged election. Now, should people go to the bush? Of course not, because that will not solve it. My argument, and it's not just mine, the Interreligious Council said this many years ago. UGSCC has said it. This is time for us to sit together as a country for a national political dialogue. But it's not a dialogue just to talk peace. No, we must address the reason, the things that have divided this country. We must address the factors of violence. We must address the factors of injustice. You have a situation where the people fear their government. You have a situation where the government fears its people. It's unbelievable what's happening here. That is why there is anarchy. So there must be a process by which we have a round table. There's a political national dialogue.
Talking of finding a way forward, as you're well aware, most of the candidates have refused to concede the election. And the main opposition leader, Dr. Kizza Besigye, if there are ways of exploring going to court, it may not be possible because he's constantly under arrest, under house arrest. He can't meet his lawyers. So if the legal recourse is taken out of the way, how do you have even a discussion?
Well, that's the point, my friend. This is not going to be solved through legalities because, again, this is a country where I have tried petitions, 2001, 2006, 2011, it was just, I think, he decided not to. So, and during the last 10 years, President Museveni has been very clear that he will be appointing cadre judges. Now, that's not to be, you know, dismiss or to say that we don't have people of repute on the bench. But truth be told, we have a massive political crisis. We have a crisis of leadership. That is not solved by legalities. That is solved by a deliberate political process. What we desperately need is that, so, yes, absolutely, Dr. Kizza Besigye, you see what's happened to him. I mean, today, I think Honorable Right Honorable Mbabazi was trying to go and visit him. He couldn't, you know. I know several people have been trying. So the point where we have reached is that, no, let us, Uganda belongs to us, you know. So I would trust and hope, and actually Dr. Kizza Besigye and Right Honorable Mbabazi, I have never said we can't talk. And, I mean, there is no way you can concede. I've been very public. You can't concede this result. If you concede this result, it means you yourself have a problem, massive problem, because it's all there to see. So I believe that is why a national political dialogue that, by the way, should include a process, a mechanism for truth-telling, because we need to deal with the historical grievances of this country and be able to determine a future together.
Do you believe there can be a national political dialogue when the incumbent president has been very clear, as you even said to him, that he has contempt for his opposition?
Well, President Museveni sadly has contempt for the whole country. But this country doesn't belong to him. It belongs to all of us. He is a Ugandan. We are all Ugandans. Whether he likes it or not, this Uganda is ours together. So we are going to have to talk, you know. Yes, he does have contempt for those that he is opponents. And yes, he has shown contempt for the whole country. I mean, that is why you have what is happening right now on the streets. That's why you have a siege, really. The feel that the country is under military siege.
Bishop David Zack Niringi is the director of the Opposition Democratic Alliance, or TDA. He spoke with reporter Douglas Mpuga from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The African Union says it will deploy scores of human rights observers and military monitors in Burundi. The announcement came at the conclusion of a visit to the country by a high-level delegation of five African presidents to the capital, Bujumbura. For VOA, Moses Havyarimana has the story.
South African President Jacob Zuma described the African Union's plan of action at the end of the 2 days of talks with the country's president and the opposition.
The AU will deploy 100 human rights observers and 100 military monitors to Burundi to monitor the situation. His Excellency President Yoweri Museveni, President of the Republic of Uganda, will convene an inclusive dialogue that will be attended by all important stakeholders as soon as possible to continue the work that he has already started of facilitating peace talk in Burundi.
Despite meeting all political stakeholders, some opposition leaders were not happy with the talks. They said the high level of the African Union delegation was not neutral and only supported the government. And they are unhappy that the government has refused to meet certain members of the opposition. Burundi Foreign Affairs Minister Alain Nyamitwe offered the government his point of view. He says the United Nations Security Council suggested talks between all peaceful members in the political dispute, but in his view, that excludes certain groups.
People who've tried to overthrow the government, people who have formed rebel groups to overthrow the government, I don't think that they have a platform here, because we didn't define who should be in those talks. It is the Security Council which did. Even if we agree with the principle of an inclusive dialogue, it has to be inclusive.
Mr. Nyamitwe said that the government is open to talks with all Burundians and will allow its citizens to voice their concerns during the dialogue. Last year, the international community suspended aid to Burundi in protest over the failure of the government to engage the opposition and over alleged human rights violations against critics. South Africa's president asked foreign governments to reconsider.
We urge the international community to support the people of Burundi in their efforts to find lasting peace and development for the country. In this regard, we urge the international community to restore the provision of assistance to Burundi as requested by the people of Burundi so that they can continue with building their country.
Burundi has been in turmoil since last April, when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in the office. Despite street protests, the president won his re-election bid. Human rights groups say more than 400 people have been killed in politically related violence since the dispute began. Moses Havyarimana, Bujumbura.
So South Sudan's rebel leader, Dr. Riek Machar, recently met with Ethiopia's Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn about the implementation of the peace agreement. The meeting came a day before Machar promised to return to Juba to take up his post as the first vice president in a transitional unity government to be led by President Salva Kiir. Machar spoke to me about the focus of his meeting with the Ethiopian Prime Minister.
Well, the focus of my meeting with the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, as you know, after the JMAC was formed, IGAD stood a little aloof. We want IGAD to remain seized to the implementation of the peace agreement. The Prime Minister of Ethiopia is the chair of the IGAD. They are the mediation. There are issues which I strongly feel that would not be resolved by JMAC. It will be only IGAD that really, and IGAD Plus, their partners, who would also assist us in the course of the implementation. For example, now the ceasefire is not holding in Equatoria. It is not holding in Bahr el Ghazal. It is not holding in parts of Upper Nile.
The government has often accused you and your troops of attacking their positions and that you are to blame for the delay of implementing the peace agreement. Supporters of Salva Kiir threatened that he should go ahead and form the unity government without you, since you are stalling and not giving South Sudanese the chance to see peace restored in the country.
Where am I stalling? What I'm saying is what is in the agreement. Some of the issues that I'm saying now, for example, the demilitarization of Juba, and then the deployment of the Joint Integrated Police and forces in Juba, in Malakal, in Bor Bentiu, this should have been done during the pre-interim period, you know. I'm not stalling in anything. I am ready to go to Juba as long as the minimal security arrangements are put in place. I think that accusation is not right. But let me talk about the violation of the ceasefire, of the permanent ceasefire. Who is on the offensive now? It is the government that is on the offensive. And the president said it during the extraordinary convention of the SPLM, that he does not recognize the forces of SPLM-IO in Equatoria, and then he would hand them down like rats. I believe you heard his statement. What was that statement? It is a military offensive. I want this to stop, and that is why I must go to Juba, you see. I'm not stalling in any form or in any way.
What would you tell the people of South Sudan following your discussions with Prime Minister Desalegn of Ethiopia and the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon? What would be your message to the people of South Sudan as you're ready to go to Juba to take up your position as the first vice president of the transitional unity government?
First, I want people of South Sudan, all of them, to support peace, whether they are armed or they are unarmed. I want all the citizens, all the population of South Sudan to support peace. Without them supporting peace, there will be no peace. Second, we on our side of the SPLM, SPLA, IO, we are committed to ensure that this peace agreement is implemented. The ceasefire must hold. We have instructed our troops to stay in their locations. In their locations. They only defend themselves if they are attacked. Like, for example, when for the last month, the last month, our troops were being attacked, our cantonment sites have been overrun by the government, but fortunately our troops resisted and we took these things back. We want peace. We want the ceasefire to hold
It is responsibility of everyone. So we must cease fire. And that is why I decided I must get to Juba. My absence in Juba should not be used an excuse for continuation of war in Equatoria in particular and in Bahr el-Ghazal, Western Bahr el-Ghazal in particular.
Riek Machar is the leader of South Sudan's rebels. He spoke with me from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. In Ethiopia, emergency aid for more than 10 million people hit by the worst drought in 50 years is expected to run out in the coming weeks unless donors step in with over $2 million of food aid. According to charity organization Save the Children, lack of additional funds could mean a potentially catastrophic escalation in severe acute malnutrition, particularly among children. Paul Dorosh is the director of the Development Strategy and Governance Division at the International Food Policy Research Institute. He explains to viewers Vincent Macquarie how the Ethiopian government prepared for the severity of the drought.
This drought is especially severe, and the government of Ethiopia has made major strides in preparation for this kind of drought and for other natural disasters in the country.
Yeah. Now, were there plans that were made to at least reduce the impact of this drought? And if so, why have they not mitigated this effect?
Well, there's been a lot of progress in the safety nets in Ethiopia over the last 10 years or so. The Ethiopian government has instituted, along with the donors, a productive safety net program. And in that program, households are identified at the local level who are in need of food assistance over time, and food aid that comes into Ethiopia and other money from the Ethiopian government is targeted to these households. So that is in place, and that productive safety net program is being scaled up now. So that's a very good channel to deal with the effects of this drought at the household level. What's especially difficult about the effects of this drought, though, is that it's especially hit hard the eastern third of the country. And there's less than 10% of the population of Ethiopia living in that eastern third. But in those pastoralist areas, these households are dependent to a large extent on their livestock. There's some crop agriculture, but livestock have been very hard hit. And that means these households have been very hard hit by water shortages and so forth. The drought has affected the highlands as well, but it's particularly severe in the eastern third of the country.
Now, every time we mention drought, we also mention famine. Do they always have to go together? I mean, must there be hunger, famine, if there's drought?
No, and the good news is that there are things that can be done. A lot of lessons were learned from that very serious famine in the mid-1980s. One of the things is that the Ethiopian government, after that, made a big effort to invest in infrastructure, in the roads, in the telecommunications, and so forth, that help move food from one place to the other, that let people know what the situation is. There's also been a big investment in agriculture over time. Ethiopia actually doubled its food production, its cereal production, in the last 10 years. So those things have been done. And then again, very importantly, getting the food to the households that are in need. This year, it's likely that cereal production will only be down perhaps 10%. But the people on that eastern third of the country are in, definitely need that relief effort.
But what I'm hearing here, there is food in the rest of the country. There's only this small part of the country that doesn't have food. So is the problem just making that food available, or rather getting it to the needy people? Is that the biggest problem?
Broadly speaking, that is perhaps one of the biggest problems. There's also an issue of those of children, mothers who have severe nutritional problems.
Paul Dorosh is the director for the Development Strategy and Governance Division at the International Food Policy Research Institute. He spoke with viewers Vincent Macquarie. This is The Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Let's kick off with athletics. Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge and Mary Keitany are the Abbott World Marathon Major Series 9 champions. This was announced earlier today after the Tokyo Marathon, the final race of the series. Keitany, who was tied along with Ethiopia's Mare Dibaba and Kenya's Helen Kiprop with 41 points, was selected as the Series 9 Women's Championship in a vote by the leaders of the 6 Abbott WMM member races in accordance with the Abbott WMM tie-breaking procedure. Kipchoge and Keitany will each earn $500,000. They were honored at an award ceremony to mark the conclusion of the year-long series that featured the Abbott WMM races. These are the Tokyo, Boston, Virgin Money London, BMW Berlin, Bank of America Chicago, and TCS New York City Marathons. Earlier, Ethiopia's Feisa Lilesa and Kenya's Helen Kiprop took the honors at the 2016 Tokyo Marathon, with pride of place between the two winners going to the latter with a course record of 2 hours, 21 minutes, and 27 seconds at the IAAF Gold Label Road Race on Sunday. In the men's race, Lilesa pulled away from Kenya's 2014 Tokyo Marathon champion and course record holder Dickson Chumba with just over a kilometer to go to win in 2 hours, 6 minutes and 56 seconds. However, despite a plethora of high finishers at major marathons, it was his first win since the 2010 Xiamen Marathon. He took a bronze medal at the 2011 IAAF World Championships, but failed to finish the marathon at the World Championships 2 years later in Moscow. Dickson Chumba came in third after he was overtaken just a few meters before the finish by his compatriot Bernard Kipyego. Behind the top three, there was a host of well-known names. London 2012 Olympic Games champion Stephen Kiprotich from Uganda was second in 2015, but finished fourth at this time. And Kenya's two-time world champion Abel Kirui was a fifth. Fellow Kenyans Eliud Kiptanui was sixth, and Emmanuel Mutai was seventh. The first Japanese runner home, Yuki Takimiya, was eighth. The women's race started at a record pace, with Kenya's Helal Kiprop and Edna Kiplagat, and the Ethiopian pair of Amane Gobena and Aberu Kabede together in the lead pace, while defending champion Birhane Dibaba had fallen off the pace. Kiprop then steadily surged away from her rivals before crossing the line in 2 hours, 21 minutes and 27 seconds and taking almost a minute of the old course record set by Ethiopia's Tifes Segaye 2 years ago. Gobena was second with a personal best of 2 hours, 21 minutes and 51 seconds. Kiplagat was third, Kabede finished fourth, while 2015 champion Dibaba was fifth. And in football, Gianni Infantino succeeded fellow Swiss Sepp Blatter as president of World Football Governing Body, FIFA. The UEFA Secretary General polled 115 votes. That was 27 more than closest rival Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim Al Khalifa. Blatter, who had led FIFA since 1998, stood down last year and was later suspended from football for 6 years for breaching ethics guidelines. Infantino is a 45-year-old lawyer from a region of Switzerland, which is less than 6 miles from Blatter's hometown of Visp. He entered the presidential race when it became clear that Michel Platini, boss of European football governing body UEFA, could not stand.
We have to be proud of FIFA, and everyone has to be proud of FIFA, and we have to be proud of what we will do together in FIFA. I would like to thank all of you, all 209, all the other candidates. We had a sporting competition. Tokyo said it, one can win and four will not win. But we had a sporting competition, and it was a great sign of democracy in FIFA. And I want to be the president of you, of all 209 national associations. I want to work with all of you together, with all of you, in order to restore and rebuild a new era in FIFA, a new era in FIFA where we can put again football in the center of the stage.
FIFA's new president speaking on Friday, soon after his election. Infantino has a hard job restoring FIFA's image after a number of damaging episodes in the organization's history. Criminal investigations in the US and Switzerland have resulted in the indictment of dozens of football officials for corruption, many of them serving or former presidents of national or continental associations. In addition, FIFA has been forced to investigate the awarding of several World Cup finals, especially the decision to grant the 2018 tournament to Russia and the 2022 finals to Qatar. And lastly, Nigeria have reappointed Samson Siasse as coach following the resignation of Sunday Oliseh earlier on Friday. The Nigerian Football Federation has ensured the coach is in place for March Nations Cup qualifiers against Egypt. Oliseh quit after only 8 months, accusing the National Federation of Football of Nigeria of contractual violations and owing salaries. The federation responded the statement saying Oliseh was last week paid a 3 months salary and half a year's rent, but admitted he's still owed a bonus. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent to enjoy.
peace till we back again. I know we getting high. Put your hands up in the sky. In the sky. Hey, yeah, you got me dancing a lingo. The way that you move in your window. Dancing a lingo. Dancing a lingo. Yeah, you got me dancing a lingo. The way that you move in your window. Dancing a lingo. Dancing a lingo. A lingo. A lingo. The way that you move in your window.
We'll be right back.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's 1 month's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The expression Africa rising has become popular in some section of the media for about a year or two. And without penetrating analysis of the essence of that expression, some African leaders have embraced it, aimed at demonstrating that they have been competent managers of the country's economy. But really, what does it mean? Are we being told that Africa is on the march? If anything is that we can say the term may apply to the mining sector. True enough, when the mining sector is booming, growth rates are high, but do we also believe that trickle-down economy applies to these mining countries? Competent global economists have already debunked the idea of trickle-down, even in the industrial countries. If you take just one example, Sierra Leone was having a phenomenal growth rate when the mining companies were booming. But in the period of Ebola, many of these mining companies collapsed, the personnel left, and I think in one case, the company declared bankruptcy. And of course, the growth rate has depressed in Sierra Leone, and the economy is now in distress. But is it also a possibility that this expression, African rising, is an attempt to lull African leaders to sleep, to make them believe they are doing all right, and there is no need for them to turn to other pathways for development, for example, looking at China or India or Brazil? And the case of China is very tempting. A few years ago, this country was in deep poverty. Yet today, China has climbed out of that stage and is now the second functioning economy in the world next to the United States. China has been able to lift millions and millions of its people from poverty. Are we then being told that the best thing to do is to look to the Bretton Woods institutions and to follow the prescriptions that they have made, and there is no need to worry? I believe that African leaders and African economists should not be tempted, because we know that this expression does not apply to the millions of Africans who are still below the poverty level, nor does it apply to the crumbling infrastructure of Africa, which has impeded intra-African trade, which is in fact an essence for economic development in Africa, or even does it apply to the health sector in many African countries? As we saw in the Ebola case, the crumbling health sector made it very difficult to cope with that crisis. So the warning for Africa is, don't be misled by expressions which have no true meaning. We have eminent economists like Professor Adedeji who have written treatises about how best to proceed. Why don't we mobilize our economists for them to give us the true picture of our economy? Beware of false prophets. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impoga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if you neglect the pot, it boils over and extinguishes the fire. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Legal experts from the U.S. Department of Commerce and the U.S. Customs and Border Protection collaborated with 20 senior officials from Sri Lanka Customs in Colombo in February on reforming customs procedures to enhance trade. The effort seeks to improve efficiency and transparency for businesses, allowing Sri Lanka to develop more fully its export potential and advance investment opportunities. The United States is working at all levels in Sri Lanka, government, private sector, and development groups, to help strengthen the economy for the benefit of all Sri Lankans, said U.S. Ambassador Atul Kishap. These reforms will send important signals to the trade community that Sri Lanka is open for business. The three-day workshop, provided in cooperation with the Embassy of the United States, will also better position Sri Lanka to meet its commitment under the World Trade Organization Agreement on Trade Facilitation. The sessions addressed issues key to Sri Lanka realizing its export-led development plan, including advanced rulings, valuation and classification, and customs appeals. In addition, the U.S. experts held a one-day training for 30 district court and magistrate judges who commonly hear customs appeals. Improving the legal environment for doing business in Sri Lanka fosters economic opportunity for local entrepreneurs and U.S. companies alike, said Megan McMillan, attorney advisor for the U.S. Commerce Department Commercial Law Development Program. She added, these ambitious reforms will strengthen Sri Lanka's connections to global supply chains while saving customs resources. These workshops are the first in a proposed series conducted in Sri Lanka in partnership with other U.S. government agencies. The United States is proud to work with its partner Sri Lanka to improve customs operations that will facilitate trade and economic development in Sri Lanka, the region, and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.